And now to our weekend spotlight with music legend Bonnie Raitt. The Rock and Roll Hall of Famer is out with her 21st album called Just Like That. It's her first new release in more than 6 years and has landed at number one on 6 different Billboard charts since its release. I sat down with her before a recent concert outside of Washington, D.C., and I asked about her dynamic 50-year career and what she's learned about herself along the way. Bonnie Raitt, thanks so much for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here and coming all the way out to a gig.
Yeah. And what's it like to be doing gigs again, to be on the road? I mean, the last 2 years, you and your band, you've been sidelined because of the pandemic.
Yeah,
it was true. But now you're back in front of live audiences again.
Well, we knew eventually, we hoped that it would end up, that people would do the right thing and so we could get safe and they figured out a vaccine. So the horizon was clearing and I just was frustrated, as we all were, that we couldn't play in front of live audiences. But I did a lot of recording in my home for Democratic candidates and various causes that I support, and I was able to participate, but just by myself, which was nowhere near as much fun as playing with the guys and playing for an audience.
Well, let's talk about this new album. It's doing incredibly well. Congratulations.
Thank you, thank you.
Most of the album are covers. How do you do that creatively? How do you take somebody else's songwriting, their arrangement, and then put your own spin on it?
You know, it's something I've always done. I mean, I grew up loving Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and Frank Sinatra and my dad, and they always put their own spin on the songs that they picked. And I love taking an older song like Del Shannon's Runaway in 1977. Yeah. I did kind of an Al Green thing on it. Mm-hmm. And then I did a Jerry Rafferty hit and turned it into a reggae song. And then we did an NXS song and a Talking Heads song over the years. So it's really fun for me. A lot of times they're either by guys, and then I put them in my key, and I put some slide on it, and it's absolutely different.
I want to talk about one of the songs that you wrote called Down the Hall.
I asked the nurse where he was going. She said, hospice down the hall.
It was inspired by a true story of a prisoner who was at a prisoner hospice, and it's told through his point of view. What drew you to that story that first appeared, I guess, in the New York Times?
Yeah, I read it in the New York Times Magazine, and I saw this photo essay with it and the article interviewing these guys that for no benefit, they don't get their sentence shortened and they don't make money. They just, you know, been in there for whatever they felt about what they did in their previous life, why they were there. I put myself in the place of a guy that was just had compassion for the guys that at the end of their life don't have anybody to hang out with them at the last moments. And the fact that there's these 75 programs I found out all over the country where prisoners can volunteer and get trained to help care and, you know, be their pal and be there at the end. And I was so incredibly moved. I thought it would make a great story.
What is it about that sort of the folk tradition of writing a song in the third person, finding an entry point through somebody else's life?
Well, I mean, great literature is that way too. I love short stories. I loved O. Henry when I was a kid, and I was very influenced by the great early songs of Bob Dylan and, you know, the whole tradition of Celtic ballads telling, you know, from the point of view of the person that they're either about to murder somebody or get murdered. You know, there's just a whole crawling inside somebody's persona, and John Prine was a real inspiration for me, who we lost last year from COVID, and his story songs on his first album, Donald and Lydia being one, and then Angel from Montgomery, which is a cornerstone of my set since the early 70s. You know, he really showed me what it's like to, you don't have to have lived that person's life to write about it. You just have to empathize.
And Living for the Ones, that I gather was a song about personal loss that you've experienced.
Yeah.
When I first heard it, I thought, oh, this is about the pandemic.
Yeah, well, it kind of is,
okay.
Yeah. It's about everybody we lost.
Well, I'm living for the ones who didn't make it. Cut down funeral for the fair own. Just keep them in mind. Every chance is denied. And you ever start to bitch and moan.
On the record in the liner notes, I started listing people that had just been passed since from the pandemic, and then some drug overdoses and cancer and accidents and suicides, and it was 14 people, and I had to stop just because we were going to run out of artwork. You know, I started doing when my brother passed from brain cancer in 2009 was I'm living every day for the life he didn't get to have. And that is literally in the lyrics of Living for the Ones. It's how do you get through? I'm living for the ones who didn't make it. You know, I'm just going to face the sun and look out the window and take a walk and take a deep breath, and that's the life they didn't get to have.
What's your songwriting process like? Do you write on the piano? Do you write on the guitar?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
I wrote Nick of Time on the keyboard. I took piano lessons when I was a kid, but my mom was an incredible piano player, and my dad's musical director. I gravitated to the guitar and taught myself to play, and for different types of songs I write on the guitar, and then kind of more personal ballads I write on the keyboards.
So many of your songs, especially on this latest album, focus on grace and redemption. How has that manifested in your life, that's something that you're focusing on in your music?
Well, it's hard to say why those stories move me. I mean, I hear in 35 years of recovery, I've heard some incredible stories in the meetings of people who just lost everything and never thought they could reconcile with their family or their parents or get a job or their health. And people find a way to reach out to each other and bring that redemption and grace and forgiveness. And that's a story that is universal and timeless.
Yeah.
But especially, I had no idea the pandemic was going to happen when I wrote the songs, but it's really resonating for me and the audience. I think that's why the album is striking a chord.
You also write a lot about relationships. My favorite song ever is I Can't Make You Love Me.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's the best song in the American Songbook. It's so evocative just from the opening, just tap on the snare. How many seconds did it take for you to hear that song and say, I have to sing it, I have to record it?
You know, Mike Reed and Alan Shamblin wrote the tune, and I think they wrote it as an up-tempo song.
Oh, wow.
And Mike just slowed it down because I'd already cut a song of his on Nick of Time.
Yeah.
And they sent it to me, and I was gobsmacked, as they say in England. I knew right away what a gift that was. They said, I think you could do a good job with this. So many other people have covered it, but I'm really grateful they sent it to me first.
Yeah.
And it moves me every night when I sing it.
I can't make you love me if you don't. You can't make your heart feel something it won't.
I was going to ask you that. Do you ever get tired of singing some of these songs that have been so enduring?
No, and I look out, I can see people's faces. You know, I've said this before in interviews, but one of my most touching parts of my life is receiving letters from women who have said, I've never seen my husband in tears before. And when you sing that song, I looked over, and for the first time in our 30-year marriage, you know, either Angel from Montgomery or I Can't Make You Love Me. It's something that's touching us all. That's just a heartbreaking song.
It really is.
I love that, Don't Patronize
Me.
Don't patronize
me. It cuts you deep.
It's deep.
You're at a really interesting point in your career in that you've been getting all of these accolades, Lifetime Achievement Awards, and yet you're still very much in your prime. What does
that
feel like, on the one hand, to be so prolific and to still be producing music, and on the other hand, being heralded as the legend that you are?
Well, it was a big surprise to be getting these awards now. But I'm so grateful that people feel that way about me. I was joking. I said, what do you guys know? Am I sick and I don't know it? I mean, but I just think that, there's not that many people that last 50 years in the business. And because of my activism and my role model as a band leader and a lead guitar player, and, you know, I do a lot of different kinds of music, and I think it's wonderful to be recognized for who I am in the world, not just the way that I sing. But I was surprised and pleasantly surprised, as I am with the reception to this record. I just was putting out another record, and I didn't expect it to get all this attention, but it feels really, on top of coming back from the pandemic, it feels fantastic.
I can't imagine the patience and the persistence that is required to navigate 50 plus years in this business. What have you learned about yourself along the way?
I've learned that I really love doing this, and I will make whatever sacrifice I need to make sure that my voice is at its peak, my health is good, I keep my band and crew and salaries and my causes supported. And I have a bigger cause than just, you know, having a blast out on stage. You know, there's a there's a higher purpose, and then there's the fun of being able to play and mix all these songs together. So I start with, I gotta do it. You know, I look at Willie and B.B. King and Tony Bennett and Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and all the other people that have lasted forever. Mm-hmm. And why would we retire? This is just too much fun.
Bonnie Raitt, the best of the best.